Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to class. And this is Bio 241, May 14th. So let's take a look at the schedule. We're going to get into diversification system, at least that one figure today, maybe talk about some other things. And that's chapter 20. So today is the 14th. We're going to talk about diversification system on Monday as well. I'm sorry, Tuesday. And then on Thursday, a week from today, is your last exam. On 14, 16, 17, and 20. I looked at the end of chapter questions on 20, and I like them all. So you should look.
Simple and difficult, correct?
There's no simple, yeah, just an end of chapter. Nothing online. Okay. And maybe we could go over those today just to make sure that what I read I really do like. So I think somebody has a textbook when we're done looking at that figure. We can look at those and talk about all that kind of stuff. Maybe I know some of the answers, but that's okay. You can always check in the back of the book. And so you have extra credit drawing today in lab and also next week, which is the figure that we're going to talk about right now. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have any questions? Okay, I don't have PowerPoints for the reproductive system, but some people said maybe they would like PowerPoints, and maybe send me an email and I can scrounge some up. Okay? Okay. Other people probably not so interested in PowerPoints. Okay, that's it. Questions. I know there's some questions. Yes. Questions regarding some of the study questions, the online questions. I hear that in different versions of the textbook, there might be identical questions, and it gives you different answers for identical questions, different versions of the book. And that usually means that the question isn't stated accurately enough to give you a nice clear choice, or maybe there's the book thinks there's one choice and there's maybe two. Or maybe the question is good, but none of the answers are really good. So let's take let me listen to what some of these questions are. And some of you probably run into that as well. Like, what is your question? Usually I like those questions because I think they're easy enough to figure out, but you do have to stop and figure them out. That's why I like them. Okay.
Cerebral blood flow remains fairly constant at about 750 milliliters per minute.
I would say that the classical answer for that is true.
Because you have to maintain constant blood flow throughout the
body. Yeah. Yeah. So he had true and false for those. I can't think of the, you know, a true false question sometimes has like a little trick to it or one little thing that negates it, but I can't see it in this part. Okay. Good. In that particular.
Similar receptors will increase their firing rate in direct response to increase in the level of blank in the cerebral spinal fluid resulting in blank ventilation. So it gives you two answers. One is increased level of acid, which causes increased ventilation, and the other one is increased CO2, which causes increased ventilation. So wouldn't it be acid? Because the H diffuses causing ventilation.
Carbon dioxide diffuses through, not protons. So I might have to listen to that question once again, but I think the correct answer would be CO2. Yeah, CO2. CO2 can diffuse through the blood-brain barrier. Okay, so when carbon dioxide moves across the blood-brain barrier, there is carbonic anhydrase in the brain, which converts the CO2 to bicarbonate and hydrogen ion. Yeah, or carbonic acid, which dissociates. That happens inside the brain.
Okay, so
yeah, we have carbonic anhydrase just about everywhere.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Okay.
Yeah. And then another one is, during fight or flight reactions, the nervous system causes vasodilation in skeletal muscles, but vasoconstriction in the skin. It is able to achieve these opposite effects by strategizing two options. One is the muscle arterioles have alpha adrenergic receptors and skin arterioles have beta adrenergic receptors, or the muscles have norepinephrine sympathetic fibers.
Oh, I'm sorry, have what? The muscles have what?
The lower energy.
Oh, cholinergic. Yeah, okay.
And the skin has energy quite much.
Okay, I like that one. Yeah.
The muscles have lower energy. Sympathetic fibers in the skin has adrenal energy.
So that's rare. That's rare. There aren't many sympathetic cholinergic receptors, but that would be an exception to the rule.
These are between 14 and 16.
So yeah, what chapter?
I think that was 14.
Chapter 14.
And if you get the thing, if they switch the word from fight or flight reaction to exercise and relaxation, right? Because there's a question where it's the same everything. It's just instead of saying fight or flight, you say exercise and relaxation. So they're not becoming the same.
Exercise and relaxation are two opposite things.
But would they not match with fight or flight? Like fight would be exercise because...
Yeah, sympathetic is exercise.
So it would be the same answer, it's just they change the word from fight to exercise.
Exercise. Yeah, exercise stimulates the sympathetic nervous system. But you asked me another question before lecture. Can you remember which one that was?
Was the one with the parasympathetic and the heart?
Oh, yeah, that's good. It's a true-false question. This is a good one.
All parasympathetic nerve fibers to the heart innervate the SA node, true or false?
Okay, all parasympathetic nerve fibers to the heart innervate the
SA
node. I would say it would be a good question if it said only SA node. Does it say only SA node?
No.
It just said, then that could be tricky. If it said only SA node, that would be false because there are parasympathetic nerves that go to the AV node, right? Now, if it just said it like that, all parasympathetics go to the SA node, maybe somebody was thinking that could be true. Because they're thinking all go to the SA node, but there are some that branch off and go to the AV node. Okay. So just know that parasympathetic signals go to both the SA and AV node.
And the sympathetic only goes to the AV node?
Sympathetic? Sympathetic. Yeah, sympathetic goes to the AV node and SA node and the ventricles as well. Basically the atrium.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the volume of electrons per minute by left ventricle.
Okay, say that again.
The volume of electrons per minute by left ventricle is the same as the volume pumped by the right ventricle. So what throws me out is, I remember that
this
the
is true.
Ventricle is 60 to 70% stronger or pumps 60 to 70% more blood.
Stronger. It develops more pressure.
So it's more pressure, but
yeah.
Same volume.
Same volume because there's a lot less resistance in the pulmonary circulation. So to get the same flow or volume of blood through the pulmonary circulation, you have to reduce the pressure.
Okay.
So the left ventricle is just stronger, develops a higher pressure to overcome a higher resistance in the systemic circulation. Okay. Okay. So write them down for next time. All right, so here is the illustration that I want to look at, because we're done looking at the schedule, right? Okay. Yeah, this is 3-3. Yeah, let's check it out. Yeah, it's kind of like, it doesn't have to be pretty, but you'd be surprised, a lot of students, once you draw it, you'll do a really good job. But you have to understand what we're looking at, right? All right, so let's look at some of the axes right here. And I see that the horizontal axis is just the time, right, just number of days of the uterine cycle. And as a matter of fact, look up over here, it says menstrual cycle, and you could say menstrual cycle, but probably a better way of talking about this is uterine cycle, because we're looking at the uterus, right? And the top graph, we're looking at the ovary, right? So we're going to call this the ovarian cycle versus day of the cycle, and the uterine cycle versus day of the cycle. So the top graph shows gonadotropin secretion, And what are some gonadotropins that we are going to be interested in? Yeah, FSH and LH. And a gonad, of course, in this particular case, is an ovary. Right, so we're looking at female reproductive tract. And we have two gonadotropins, FSH and LH. Nice. We're going to look at what the effects are here. And notice that they're not constant over the uterine cycle. And then we have something that looks like what? Ovarian events. Wow, really hard to read that. Ovarian events. And what we're looking at is a follicle inside the ovary. And there's an egg that's surrounded by a bunch of material, and that's what we call a follicle. So a follicle is this whole system right here, including an egg. On the bottom graph, we see a couple profiles of hormones secreted by the ovary, namely estrogen and progesterone. All right, so it's going to be secreted by something that we see up on the top graph over here, and then what the effects are on the uterus, and in particular the endometrium of the uterus, right? Not the myometrium. There's probably some effects on the myometrium, but we're just going to look at the endometrium. And what does it say over here? Thickness of endometrium. Very good. Okay. So FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, at the beginning of the uterine cycle is relatively high, and it does what its name suggests, is that it stimulates a follicle, a number of follicles, to start to mature so that an egg can be ovulated. And then usually only one of these follicles out of a handful go all the way to maturation that will ovulate an egg. And on this graph right here, I only see one that successfully does that. Right, but there can be certain circumstances where there might be two that could be produced non-identical twins, right? But usually there is just one. So FSH is high. FSH is going to stimulate, right, the development of a follicle. So that's what this arrow here represents. LH plays some role in that, but if I was just going to pick one thing, I would say FSH causes maturation of a follicle. And then right at mid-cycle, I see that FSH kind of spikes a little bit and then goes back down right around day 14. But look at the spike in luteinizing hormone. It's even greater. And I want you to know that this spike in luteinizing hormone causes this process to happen. And I see an egg, right, being ejected from a mature follicle, and that's what we call ovulation. So what hormone is most responsible for ovulation? Luteinizing hormone. Okay. All right, so the hormone that is responsible for maturation of a follicle is FSH. LH does play a role. Some of these other hormones play a role, but FSH is the most important. And then right at mid-cycle, there's a positive feedback mechanism that establishes itself so that when there is an increase in LH, there's an increase in gonadotropin-releasing hormone from the hypothalamus, which causes more LH, which causes more release of gonadotropin-releasing hormone from the hypothalamus, and you have this big spike. And how come the whole universe is not filled up with luteinizing hormone if there's this nice feedback mechanism happening? Usually something drastic has to happen. Do you see anything drastic happening right here? I see ovulation. Yeah, that's a pretty drastic situation, right? Because after ovulation, you no longer have a follicle. Something just completely goes away. All right, so here we have this oocyte. And if I look at, kind of just a side note, if I look at this oocyte right here, do I see that it has any surface specializations for motility? Can it move around by itself? I heard yes or no, and probably everybody's going to agree with me. No, because I don't see cilia, I don't see flagellum, right? So this egg right here is just floating around in the fluid that's outside of the ovary. And so you might be wondering, well, how does it get to the uterus then? Or how does it find a sperm if it can't move around, right? Because that's its job. All right, so the ovulation releases an egg, and the leftover follicle does not degenerate. It becomes a very important endocrine organ. And we call this the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum secretes progesterone. Right? So that's its main job. So here's a corpus luteum, corpus luteum, corpus luteum secreting progesterone. And if we look down on the profiles of estrogen and progesterone at the beginning of the uterine cycle, we can see that estrogen is high and then is slowly increasing. It matches what? The development of a follicle in the follicular phase of the ovary. So estrogen, okay, is produced by this developing follicle. And right at ovulation, see, it peaks right before ovulations, and then right at ovulation, what happens to estrogen? It starts to decline because there's no longer a follicle there, and another hormone starts to increase, and that is progesterone. So the corpus luteum is responsible for progesterone secretion, but a developing follicle is responsible for estrogen secretion. Right? These things do play a role together. There's an interaction, but I just want you to know one important thing that happens. Okay, so FSH causes maturation of a follicle. LH causes ovulation. And the developing follicle secretes estrogen. And then after ovulation, that leftover follicle becomes the corpus luteum. But that's a very important endocrine gland because what's the hormone that the corpus luteum secretes? Progesterone. Right, and the old name for, or the old term for progesterone is progestational hormone. What's gestation? Pregnancy. Yeah, it's a period, that's a term of pregnancy, and pro means it supports pregnancy, so progesterone is a hormone that is secreted when somebody is pregnant or when the lining of the uterus is in a condition that can accept implantation or maintain pregnancy. Progestational hormone. So then I see degeneration of the corpus luteum toward the end of the cycle, and that actually signals the end of the cycle, and you can see that progesterone starts to decline as the corpus luteum regresses. All right, and as progesterone levels decrease and estrogen levels decrease, then this functional layer of the endometrium is sloughed off and is washed out of the body with a mild hemorrhage. And the process starts all over again. All right, so in this particular condition, or this particular graph that we're looking at, has implantation taken place? Does this figure show fertilization and implantation? Do we have an embryo? Okay, I don't see it in the endometrium here, but if we look at these hormone profiles, you can tell right away, because if implantation did take place, what's going to happen to progesterone? It's going to, right, it's certainly not going to decrease, it might stay the same, or it might increase as well. All right, so what you should be aware of is that if implantation does take place, progesterone levels remain high, and where does this progesterone come from? Right where I have? Yeah, the corpus luteum. And in the initial phase of pregnancy, this progesterone does come from the corpus luteum. So there's got to be a signal, right, that is sent to the corpus luteum not to regress. And that is a third kind of hormone that's really important, and that's called human chorionic gonadotropin. It's not on this slide because this slide doesn't talk about pregnancy. But human chorionic gonadotropin comes from the placenta, right? The developing placenta secretes human chorionic gonadotropin. It also secretes some estrogen and progesterone, but in the early phases of pregnancy, the placenta is very, very small. This corpus luteum is very sensitive to human chorionic gonadotropin, and that prevents regression of the corpus luteum. So if there's implantation, there's a placenta. Placenta releases a hormone that maintains the corpus luteum, right, until later on in pregnancy. And the corpus luteum, what's the job of the corpus luteum once again? Yeah, to secrete progesterone, to maintain the endometrium. All right, so this top graph right here shows us what's happening in the ovary, so we call that the ovarian cycle. And the ovarian cycle is controlled by two hormones, FSH and LH. And where do these come from? Where does FSH and LH come from? FSH and LH, okay, FSH and LH, I wouldn't necessarily say they come from an ovary or in the male, a testes. Okay. Where are these things coming from? I'm glad I asked that question. Okay. They're coming from the pituitary, exactly right, and it's the anterior pituitary. So maybe jot that down. And how does the anterior pituitary know to secrete FSH and LH? Yeah, there's a releasing hormone or releasing factor from the hypothalamus, and it's called GnRH, releasing hormone. I haven't really seen a GnRF very often, GnRH. Okay. All right, so that's from the anterior pituitary. You should definitely know that. All right, and then so FSH work on the ovary to help a follicle mature. That's a response due to increasing levels or levels of FSH. Ovulation is called by the spike in luteinizing hormone. And then after ovulation, then the corpus luteum just takes over. All right. And eventually it will regress unless it gets a signal from a placenta someplace saying that there's a successful implantation, in which case then the corpus luteum keeps secreting progesterone that maintains the lining of the uterus and the pregnancy can continue. The corpus luteum eventually does regress because the placenta, when it's maturing, can secrete by itself enough progesterone, right, to maintain the uterine lining, right? So the placenta takes over, I think, after about 5 weeks. It's strong enough to do that. Okay. So the one thing that we didn't look at is the endometrium. I'm trying to remember if there's other things that I forgot to talk about. But here is the endometrium. And I see that the endometrium is getting thicker and thicker and thicker. And so what is happening to the endometrium as we see it getting thicker and thicker and thicker? There's a couple things that you could talk to me about, but one thing. Okay. And that one thing has to do with why we name this part of the uterine cycle, the proliferative phase. So that's a clue that I'm thinking. What does proliferation mean? Proliferation means, okay, in one word, it means mitosis, right? I'm not quite sure I understood what you guys were saying, but were you close to mitosis?
Yeah.
Not close, okay. Okay, so what does mitosis mean? You start with one cell, yeah, and then you end up with two, and then you end up with four, right? And then 8, 16, kind of an exponential growth factor. So cells are what? Growing. They're reproducing themselves in an asexual fashion, right? All those cells are going to be exactly the same. So there is a lot of cell growth due to mitosis. Right? So that mitosis is being stimulated by high levels of or increasing levels of estrogen. Okay, estrogen right here. All right, so can you see that the tail of this arrow goes right to the estrogen curve, passes the progesterone, goes up to estrogen? All right, so increasing estrogen levels causes growth of the endometrium, right? And what we mean by that is mitosis, right? There's an increase in cells in the endometrium, and that increase of cells is what we call proliferation, right? And so here's the proliferative phase of the uterine cycle. Right. There's some other things that happen. As these cells grow, they need increased vascular supply, so the blood supply to this layer increases. And there are also some glands in the endometrium that secrete a product. And so the glands also develop. But progesterone is necessary for the final maturation of the glands as well as the endometrium. So it stimulates the final development of the blood supply and the glands in the endometrium. And I'm not familiar with what exactly these glands secrete, the name of the compound and what the function is, but everybody just assumes it's something that aids in implantation. Okay, but I really don't know what the relationship is between those chemicals and that fertilized egg. Okay, so you could consider these things uterine glands right here. And since they're uterine glands, right, they're going to secrete some kind of product. So This phase is called the secretory phase. Right, so the secretory phase is due to increasing progesterone and even increasing estrogen, right, after this dip after ovulation, okay, produces the secretory phase. And then as the corpus luteum regresses, progesterone goes away, what happens to the endometrium then? It starts to degenerate, right, and is sloughed out of the body with this period of hemorrhage. All right, so most of these endometrial cells leave the body, but every once in a while, some of these endometrial cells, since they're in the uterus, they can maybe get into the fallopian tube, and they can exit the fallopian tube out through the fimbria, pass by the ovary, and these endometrial cells might find a vascular supply in a mesentery someplace or a superficial blood vessel on the uterus. Right, or maybe even around the ovary, right? So we have these living endometrial cells, and that can cause a severe irritation of the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. And guess what we call that condition? Yeah, endometriosis. Okay, so endometriosis is when these endometrial cells somehow go retrograde through the reproductive system. Instead of being lost in the body, they end up in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. And then, during the proliferative phase, when estrogen is high, what happens to those endometrial cells that are in the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity? They start to proliferate, right? So increasing that inflammation. And that can be really serious. Some women can't lead anywhere near a normal life when that happens. And then they try to remove those endometrial cells because they form something that almost looks like a tumor in a sense, right? Because it's growing. Right, but then after ovulation, what happens, or at the end of the cycle, what happens to those endometrial cells? They start to regress, right? So the inflammation starts to decrease once again, but it might not wholly go away while the next cycle starts. So sometimes surgical intervention is necessary. So it's sort of like a cancer, except what? Those endometrial cells are trapped in the abdominal and pelvic cavity, they can't go anywhere, right? They can't go to your liver, can't go to your brain, can't go to your bone. So it's not really like metastatic cancer, even though it's sort of, the process sort of resembles it a little bit, right?
So how does like one know that that's happening?
Yeah, it hurts, and hurts, but I mean, it might hurt anyways. It's a pain that I really don't know, okay? So how does one diagnose endometriosis? There might be ways of monitoring some hormone profile. I don't know what I would look at. If there is a lot of tissue, then you can see it on an imaging study, like maybe an MRI or a CT or maybe an ultrasound. It might show up, but that's something that I have to look up. I don't know how I would diagnose it. Yeah. Let me consider that. We can think about a birth control pill. Okay, and before we do that, let's think about these hormone profiles. Okay, as progesterone increases, right, and estrogen increase, there are progesterone and estrogen receptors in the hypothalamus. Okay, and as estrogen and progesterone increase, the hypothalamus knows that. What do you think the hypothalamus is going to do with gonadotropin-releasing hormone? Yeah, it's going to cut it back, right, to maintain homeostasis. All right, so if somebody is, and what is that gonadotropin? It's going to cause maturation of a follicle and ovulation, right? Okay, so if somebody's taking exogenous estrogen and progesterone, for instance, in a birth control pill, and there's many different kinds of combinations of these things, what is ultimately happening inside a woman's body? That exogenous estrogen and progesterone go to the hypothalamus, right? And it causes the shutdown of GnRH. So if GnRH disappears, what happens to FSH? Yeah, it goes down. And so what happens then? Then a follicle can't mature, right? So ovulation is inhibited. when that happens, right? So if you maintain high levels of progesterone and estrogen, that inhibits maturation of a follicle and ovulation because of that feedback mechanism. So that's a pretty handy way of doing that. But the profiles of estrogen and progesterone change over the uterine cycle, and I don't know if there are any birth control pills that prevent menstruation, right? So at this point in time, then birth control formulation of estrogen and progesterone should decrease as well, right? So that would maintain more of a normal uterine cycle and only changing the ovarian cycle. Yeah. Okay. So that also, and I don't know this for sure either, but after menopause, right, when all of these hormones start to decrease, that probably also gives some relief to somebody that has endometriosis because, why? Because these estrogen levels decrease and these endometrial cells, right, don't have a signal to proliferate. And I would probably have to Google that. That's just a guess on my part.
Okay.
Okay, why is it hard to become pregnant after they stop birth control? Yeah, it certainly can. I don't have a good explanation for why that is. Okay. Maybe I'll wake up with one tomorrow. I don't know. Something I haven't really thought about. Nothing's popping out in my mind. I didn't know that. I didn't know it's hard to get pregnant. Because, you know, this pregnancy thing is just strange.
Yeah.
I mean, because somebody can try to become pregnant for years and years and years and then give up trying to become pregnant, and then all of a sudden they end up with one kid, and then 5 months later they're pregnant again. All right, so I'm not quite sure what's going on. But because FSH and LH come from the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus is in the brain, the hypothalamus can get inputs from all different parts of the brain, right? So stress, emotional condition, who knows everything that's involved right there. But that's interesting. I'll try to research that as well. So what else do I want to say with this particular figure? We talked about the proliferative phase. So if we say proliferative phase and secretory phase, we're talking about what organ in the body? Yes, the uterus. And what layer of the uterus? The endometrium in particular. All right, so if we say follicular phase, what organ are we talking about in the body? The follicular phase, where do we have follicles? That's a really good question. Where do we have follicles? In a uterus? No, ovaries, right? So follicular phase is, it's a description of what's happening in the ovary, not the uterus. And of course, if we say ovulation, what organ are we talking about? The ovary, right? Ovary. And if we say luteal phase, we're talking about what, the uterus or ovary?
Ovary,
right? Because that's where the corpus luteum exists. Doesn't exist in the uterus. All right, so that's why I like to label these things ovarian cycle and uterine cycle. Not so much menstrual cycle, but of course, that is an important thing. Okay, now who's got some questions? Anybody got any questions about this? You guys seem to be a little intimidated before we start talking about this figure. What about now? Does it seem a little bit more? Seems a little bit more familiar with it? Okay. Yeah, this is the extra credit for next week. Yeah, so you don't have to draw all these fancy structures inside the corpus luteum, all these fancy structures in a follicle that's developing, but just make sure that your follicle is what? Bigger and then bigger and then bigger and then bigger, okay? And as far as the endometrium, okay, starting around day 4, what happens to the endometrium? You don't have to draw all these fancy structures. It gets what? Thicker and thicker and thicker, and that should tell you what phase the uterine cycle is, and that is proliferative phase, because that means mitosis, right? And why is the second half of the uterine cycle called the secretory phase? Yeah, because it's secreting something. If somebody knows something about what the uterus is secreting, maybe you could tell us right now or maybe next week. But I don't know exactly what it is. Okay, but it aids in implantation. Okay. All right, so I think that's all I need to say about this particular figure, unless you have some more questions. Questions? Okay. Well, still keeping this figure, maybe you can remember, and I had a slide of the female reproductive system. I can't find it. I can't find my anatomy pictures right here. Let me just look one more time. Lecture PowerPoints. I don't know what happened to my anatomy pictures. So I think you guys are going to have to use your imagination just a little bit. Okay? Okay, so here we have an egg that's been ovulated. All right, and is this little cell motile? You already told me. It's not, because it doesn't have a cilia or flagellum. Okay, so how does it make its way from the ovary through the fimbria, which is the open end of the fallopian tube, through a fallopian tube to a uterus, where it should go? Do you have a picture in your mind of like a fallopian tube, what it looks like in uterus? Like peristalsis. Maybe you can invoke peristalsis of a fallopian tube. I would say, as far as my knowledge goes, that's a very minor, if existent at all. Okay, so peristalsis would be a really good guess. Okay, so you have a fallopian tube, right? And fallopian tubes don't have a flagella. That's not loaded with cells with flagella, because only a sperm has a flagellum, right? But there are many cells in your body have another surface specialization for motility, and that is? Yeah, cilia, right? Like the lining, the pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium of your trachea is ciliated, and all of these cilia are sweeping up to your mouth. All the cilia in the fallopian tube are sweeping and produce a little flow from the fimbria back into the uterus, right? So the egg gets trapped in that flow. The other thing that happens, picture the fimbria, right? Is that a nice, smooth, sharp edge, or is it ruffled? Yeah, it's ruffled, right? So it kind of looks like a little hand with fingers, right, over the ovary. And as a matter of fact, that fimbriated edge, those fingers, the fimbria are actually sweeping over the ovary all the time. They're moving over the ovary, and they are ciliated, and that motion, okay, and the cilia then will trap an egg so that it gets into the fallopian tube to begin with in the first place. All right, so that's how that egg gets it down through the fallopian tube. Well, you can imagine it's a relatively delicate structure, and so I think I want to talk about some pathology just for a little bit. So this egg, right, just has to go with the flow. If the fallopian tube, yeah, it just goes with the flow. If the fallopian tube is scarred in any way, then that motion by cilia is disturbed. And then what happens to this egg? Well, it's certainly impeded, and it might stop. If the scarring is severe, then a fallopian tube can even become occluded. It's no longer patent, in which case this egg really can't get to the uterus at all, right? It's because it's blocked. Yeah. Yeah, how does all this scarring happen? Any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, okay? And so that could be a sexually transmitted disease or any other kind of infection, right? Not necessarily just sexually transmitted disease. Maybe a placement of an IUD or something caused, and that's always a high risk of infection. An IUD is a device that's used for to prevent pregnancy. And if that causes an inflammation, then the fallopian tubes can be scarred, and it's a matter of degree. How much scarring is there? All right, so here we have this egg, okay, relying on those cilia to get to the uterus, and if it can't get there, right, then its motion just stops, right? It can't attach itself to a flagellum, a sperm, and the sperm pull it into the uterus. That just doesn't happen. All right, so let's just say that there's a partial blockage of a fallopian tube, and the oocyte can't get through there, but the blockage is not large enough to impede the motion of sperm, because sperm are motile, right? When sperm are in the vagina, they move through the cervical canal, right, into the uterus, and from the uterus into a fallopian tube, and they can swim into the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, right? Because they can go anywhere they want to. And if there is an egg trapped in the fallopian tube, then fertilization can take place in the fallopian tube, but then, right, that zygote can't move. It's just trapped in the fallopian tube. Or if the fimbria is damaged, and this ovulated egg can't even get into the fallopian tube, it just starts to wander around in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, it can be fertilized there as well, right? Because the sperm go everywhere. And what can you tell me about mesentery? Have you ever seen any mesentery, like small intestine? Okay, yeah, it's a membrane, and it's pretty thin. You can look through it maybe in lab, anatomy lab, you kind of spread it out, kind of looks like a fan, and you can see some blood vessels in there, right? All right, so mesentery is loaded with blood vessels, and so that fertilized egg could implant into mesentery, for instance. And when you look at that membrane, it was really thin and transparent. How much muscle is in mesentery? None whatsoever, right? Okay, it's basically just some very loose connective tissue. And if implantation does take place, then a blood supply from the mesentery does help the growing of that blastocyst, right, after that implantation. But since there's no muscle, as the blastocyst grows bigger and bigger and bigger, it just rips away from the mesentery, and it then causes a hemorrhage of all those blood vessels that have grown in to maintain that. Actually, there's a placenta that starts to develop, right? But it just rips away because there's no muscles holding it in place. And that can be a massive hemorrhage. And a lot of times that's fatal when that happens, okay? So what do we call that kind, what do we call that process where there is implantation of a fertilized egg in a location other than a normal location? If there's, yeah, so implantation, not fertilization. Fertilization normally takes place in the fallopian tube, but implantation in particular, and I think I heard the correct answer floating around, that is called an ectopic pregnancy. All right, so who's at risk for an ectopic pregnancy? How could you maybe consider, are you at risk for ectopic pregnancy? Okay, what, somebody asked me, what scars the fallopian tube? Yeah, any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, a woman will be at a higher risk of ectopic pregnancy, right? And it's a very dangerous situation. Years ago, right, a woman would go into the emergency room complaining of severe pain, cramps, maybe in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, and could not be diagnosed. And sometimes then they were released with the information to maybe take some aspirin and come back in the morning if the pain persists. So that was pretty good advice, except that a lot of women never made it to the next day because that ectopic pregnancy would rip away and they would die of a massive hemorrhage in the abdominal and pelvic cavity. All right, so that's why ectopic pregnancies are so dangerous. And there was a time when physicians weren't so familiar with ectopic pregnancies that they would actually hang a sign in the emergency room. And the sign was, think ectopic, because nobody wanted to miss that diagnosis because it's so deadly. Think ectopic. And as a matter of fact, you should maybe hang a sign in your own mind as well right now. Okay. So what goes through your mind if somebody has that severe pelvic or abdominal pain? Well, you ask yourself some questions. Is it a woman, right? Okay, that's obvious. Is it a woman of childbearing years? Are you in that age range? And then what else has to happen? That would be helpful. Yeah, is there any history of pelvic inflammatory disease? But the other thing, and you're exactly right, the other thing you want to ask, all right, is this person sexually active? If they're not sexually active, no ectopic pregnancy, right? So those are some four questions. I thought of three, but I like your question a lot too, right? Is there a history? Don't necessarily have to have a history, or maybe it's just unknown. Maybe the history is just unknown. And you might say, well, how is that possible for it to be unknown if somebody has a pelvic inflammatory disease? Well, sort of later on in life, I went in to get an x-ray of my ankles, because it hurt really bad, and the physician came out and said, oh, you broke your ankle before. Well, I really had not known that. So if I didn't know I broke an ankle, it's possible that somebody could have pelvic inflammatory condition and not really notice it, right? Okay. So that maybe answers that question a little bit. So if all those questions line up, then probably an ultrasound is in order, or look at some hormone profiles. Okay. What kind of hormone, after what we just learned right here, what hormone would you want to observe and keep track of? Okay. Well, we got progesterone right here. That'd be pretty good, but there's a little bit something more direct. Okay. More direct. What hormone tells you that a placenta is growing, especially early on in pregnancy? Not later on in pregnancy, but early on. There's a hormone that says, hey, I'm here. Don't abandon me. Yeah, that human chorionic gonadotropin from the placenta is going to be secreted to maintain the corpus luteum. And every day that human chorionic gonadotropin should increase a little bit, right? And if it increases a little bit, that's a pretty good sign that you have a normal implantation. But if it increases and increases and then all of a sudden starts to decrease, what could that be a sign of? Okay, well, that's a sign of fetal distress or placental distress because the human chorionic gonadotropin is going down. And that could be an indication of ectopic pregnancy, right? And if certainly that is the case, then they'll probably do a bunch of imaging studies just to check and see what's happening.
Okay.
Yeah, they have to surgically remove it. So resection of a fallopian tube if they know it's there, right? Unfortunately, that kind of surgery does what to a fallopian tube? The initial stimulus there was scarring, and then after surgery, what do you have? Yeah, more scarring, right? Okay. And by the time that surgery takes place, I think physicians get a lot of questions. Well, can you take that pregnancy and put it where it belongs, right? And the answer is no. Usually by the time it's diagnosed, then that fetus is no longer viable, unfortunately. All right, so which kind of leads me to the point of if you know anybody that is pregnant early on and they're experiencing pelvic or abdominal pain, what should be your attitude for that? Think ectopic, right? Okay, and it's kind of along the lines if you have a family member that has hypertension, right? You have to be really supportive. And sometimes it's really difficult because I know a lot of women that would rather die than get a diagnosis that they have an ectopic pregnancy, right? So you really have to support these people, get them into the emergency room, and you might even save their lives if that happens. Right? So that's really, really important. Okay. So I think I only need to talk about one other thing. And it's really not on this diagram, but sort of on this diagram. What is the strongest muscle in the human body?
Eyes.
Strongest muscle? Your thighs? Oh, thighs. I thought you said eyes. Muscle in the eye? Smiling muscle? My smiling muscle, yeah, is pretty powerful. Okay. Well, I mean, you might be right, depending on who you're talking to, but I want to change your opinion a little bit. Arnold Schwarzenegger's got these big, huge skeletal muscles, right? Biceps. I don't know how much weight he can lift, right? 200 pounds with one arm, I really don't know, maybe close to that. All right. Well, can he lift a 9-pound weight with his arm and hold it there for 9 months? No. You're saying yes. Well, you know him better than I do. Okay, I would say no, he can't. All right, so that's a clue as to what the correct answer is. It is the cervix, yeah, part of the uterus, right? That's got to be the strongest muscle in the human body because I don't know anything that can hold weight for that long a period of time. Can you picture where the cervix is and what it kind of looks like? All right, it's right at the junction between vagina and uterus, right? And what kind of shape does it have? It's a dome-shaped structure, right? And the indentations around the ring of the cervix, those are called fornices. Anterior fornix, right? So it's a dome-shaped structure. And there is a process, I think there's still, I had 4,000 people, but that's dye of cancer, but that, unfortunately that was, that's colon cancer. I forget how many people die of cervical cancer in the United States. It might be on that same order, thousands of women, okay? And today, generally recognized that cervical cancer is, nobody should die. It should be 100% curable. Why is that happening? So my question is, it's a strange question, is sexually, is cancer a sexually transmitted disease? Okay. Okay. Can cancer be a sexually transmitted disease? Okay. And I really like this. Years ago, people would just say no and really argue with me. Okay. There is a virus called human papillomavirus, and there we know about, well, over 100 strains of human papillomavirus, and today we know that 4 of those strains can infect the cervix and over a period of time cause changes in the cervix, which leads to cervical cancer, which untreated, of course, is fatal. And so that's the importance of getting a routine pap smear, and usually human papillomavirus is sexually transmitted, and typically we think that the younger the woman is, the more sensitive the cervix is. All right, so if you're in your 50s, you probably don't have to worry about cervical cancer or being infected with human papillomavirus. So if you're to get rid of human papillomavirus, then that will protect you from cervical cancer. Right? So I would say yes, in a way of thinking, cervical cancer is a sexually transmitted disease because it's produced by a virus. You get that from sexual contact. And so what else kind of supports that thinking? There is recently some way that you can protect yourself from cervical cancer to help protect the cervix. Yeah, vaccine. And I think there's 2 out there right now. Gardasil is one of them, right? And so, again, that kind of lends support that, at least that, it, well, for sure, the HPV infection can be prevented with a vaccine, and that protects you from cervical cancer. Not all forms of cervical cancer. There are some other things which can produce cervical cancer, but that's probably the majority right there. Okay, so cervical cancer takes years to develop, and the surgery is, in my opinion, relatively easy, right? We don't have to go into an abdominal cavity or pelvic cavity or anything, but with a little cryoablation, some freezing of the cervix, then those strange cells, or precancerous cells, or cancer cells are destroyed, and usually that is curable. Right? So that's a cure that produces curing of that particular condition. All right, so cervical cancer can be treated very effectively, and so it's just a shame that so many women die of cervical cancer because they're just not aware of how cervical cancer develops in most cases. What's another way to prevent cervical cancer? Yeah, somebody mentioned that. I didn't want to mention that. I'm glad somebody did as well. Abstinence, right? So cervical cancer is completely preventable, completely curable if it is diagnosed early, right? It's curable if it's diagnosed early. And how is it diagnosed? With a pap smear. Yeah, very easy with a pap smear. I guess some cases can be missed, but usually pap smears are really good with that. Okay, so don't forget your pap smears. That can save you from cervical cancer and maybe some other things as well. Okay. So what's the function of the reproductive system once again? I forgot. Yeah, procreation. But that's not really what we talked about last time. It does. Right, it makes little humans. But what's something really noteworthy about all those little humans? Diversity. They're all different from each other, right? So the way that you should think about that is the reproductive system produces something that is new and unique, right? New and unique. That's the purpose of the reproductive system, to produce something that's new and unique. And the side effect of that is that it's human as well. Okay? Okay, but you and unique is the important thing. Okay. That's pretty much it for today. Next time, you know what? We could start going over some of the end of chapter questions, but next time we'll do that as well. So on Tuesday we can look at those end of chapter questions, and I do like all of them.
For chapter 20.
Yeah, all of the end of chapter questions. There are answers in the back of the textbook, but we might have to talk about some of the mechanisms involved so you can understand why those answers are correct. Online questions? I don't know of any online questions for chapter 20. Are there available? Yes. I haven't found a nice subset that I would recommend that you do. End of chapter questions. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. What are the multiple choice? Check your understanding.
Yeah.
Check your understanding. I did like some of the quantitative questions because quantitative questions had to do with this graph right here. So check your understanding and quantitative question. Quantitative questions were just reading things off this graph. Chapter review at the end of the chapter. Test your knowledge is number one, and then quantitative questions number two.
Okay.
And the quantitative questions, I think, exclusively deal with this graph right here. Oh, yeah, that's really good. So I'll probably have questions on the test. Say, what hormone is responsible for ovulation? What hormone is responsible for the proliferative phase?
Is
LH. And the proliferative phase, if you're going to pick one hormone, it's going to be estrogen.
And those are the end of the chapter questions, right?
Yes.
What about weekly?
Yeah.
Do I?
You know, for your Blackboard type question?
Yeah. I didn't recall I even had a quiz.
Yeah, you had a weekly quiz.
Okay. Wouldn't surprise me that those are the same as the end of chapter questions or something very similar. Okay, so online and end of chapter. And this thing right here. Okay, so probably, maybe 12 questions per chapter, something like that? Something like that on the last exam. How many... Take a look. How many? So we got four. So that'd be 25 questions per chapter, but we're going to have some from figures. All right, so maybe 15 questions per chapter, multiple choice, something like that. Plus diagrams.
That's what you've been doing, right?
Yeah, basically, I tried to break up all the questions on a test evenly between the chapters that I've asked you to look at.
Including 20.
Yes, including 20. All right, so sometimes when there are a lot of chapters on a test, did we ever have a test with a lot of chapters?
No.
Yeah, then I would cut down the number of questions per chapter, but they're pretty much equalized. Okay. So any other online questions? End of chapter questions? Yes, only diagram in the chapter. And you know what? If you can draw this diagram out, that will really help you on the lecture exam. And you can write on the test, so if you need to draw it out on a lecture exam to answer some of the questions, then of course you're welcome to do that.
That one's on the lecture exam too.
This right here, this is the only figure in 20 that's going to be on the test. Okay, this is the only one. So yes. And an extra credit. It is both.
Better now.
Yeah. So if you want to go over this again next time, that's fine with me too. Okay. All right, so look it over, come back with some questions, sign the sign-in sheet for today, and bring it on down.